We're very lucky this morning to have Dr. Gemma Cruz speaking with us. She's taught for a number of years in the United States before coming to join us here in Australia, where she is now a senior lecturer in theology with the Australian Catholic University based in Melbourne. I think a number of you know that her main research focus is in migration. She doesn't just theologise about migration in an abstract way. Her life experience is also one of migration. She's a significant author in this field, and I think probably upstairs at level 4 at the bookshop you might find a copy of An Intercultural Theology of Migration, Pilgrims in the Wilderness. Gemma also has another book coming out shortly, and I'm looking forward very much to hear more of what she has to say to us this morning. Please, Gemma.
Good morning. So my presentation, I've structured it into 4 parts. I will begin with a brief introduction, followed by a discussion on migrant spirituality, which I describe and present here in terms of 4 characteristics. The name of the file is Sydney PowerPoint. Still looking for the file. Okay. Anyway, so these 4 characteristics, which are actually in the description, in the abstract of the presentation, are courageous hope, creative resistance, steadfast faith, and festive community spirit. I will then offer reflections on how we might understand, envision, and do mission today in view of such spirituality. I present these reflections here in 3 points. The first one, mission among the crucified people, mission as pilgrimage in the wilderness, and mission as a consistent ethic of hope and life. And then I will end with a brief conclusion. So as a way of beginning, let me offer a quick sketch of the global migration landscape. Scholars say that at no other point in history has the number of people on the move at such a large scale that the current historical period is being referred to as the age of migration. The International Organization for Migration, for instance, says that there are 214 million people living outside their country of origin. Moreover, IOM reports that the figure could rise to as much as 405 million by 2050. Today, 1 in 33 persons in the world is a migrant, and about 3% of the world's population is comprised of migrants. While the percentage may seem minuscule, it actually represents a lot of people. In fact, if all the migrants in the world were to come together to constitute a country, theirs would be the world's 5th most populous. So, migrant spirituality. From their human condition, from tragedy and hope, from their situation of grace and disgrace, migrants make known the passing of God through history. In fact, faith-based language for the migration experience is not new. The Bible, which is dotted with stories of people like Abraham and Ruth, who found hope and liberation by crossing borders, frequently uses migration as a metaphor for human spiritual journeys. In contemporary times, the epic and tragic nature of many migration stories, together with stories of triumphs and defeats, failures and successes, often inspire a quickening of faith and an attentiveness to the matters of the spirit. The spirituality, which is concerned with the death dimension of human existence, is about the authentic human quest for ultimate value. Sandra Schneider defines it as the experience of conscious involvement in the project of life integration through self-transcendence toward the ultimate value one perceives. So how might migrant spirituality be described? What, in other words, are the Christian spiritual values involved in the migrant's quest for the ultimate value? In plumbing the depths of the migrant experience, I posit that 4 characteristics could describe migrant spirituality. The first one is courageous hope. If there is one thing that all migrants will agree on, it is the fact that migrating is never easy. It takes courage to migrate. It is a long, complicated, and difficult process that never truly and fully ends, even long after one has successfully moved physically from one country to another. First of all, migrants have to make the agonizing decision to leave. Because it is often forced, it carries with it tremendous anguish. Even those who go through proper channels have their fair share of painful experiences. The difficulties are worse, of course, for those who brave the elements. This is true for African migrants coming into Europe via Spain or Italy, especially via the sea, where Red Cross estimates puts the number of deaths between 2,000 to 3,000 every year. Here in Australia, we see and hear from time to time horrific images and stories of those trying to come into the country through perilous sea journeys. Oftentimes, the difficulties are worst for those who are not only at the mercy of the elements, but unscrupulous people as well. Irregular, also known as undocumented, I usually try not to use the word illegal, actually. Migrants crossing the southern border of the U.S., for example, must entrust themselves to the coyotes. Coyotes, more popularly known here as the people smuggler. And sometimes this is a fatal mistake for various reasons. The coyote will lead people over the border only to rob them on the other side. Other times, coyotes will leave immigrants stranded in the middle of the desert to become disoriented and die of dehydration. Still other times, they will have unsuspecting migrants carry the coyote's backpack, which may have drugs in it. If officials apprehend a group, sometimes these same immigrants can be the ones sent to jail. What is striking is that despite the dangers, thousands of men and women, especially from the global south, still move across borders on a daily basis. In the name of their families, they risk their life and their limb just to get into the land of their dreams. In the words of Julio, we are aware of the dangers, but our need is greater. The enormity of the threats and dangers for these migrants during their journeys is such that Dante's inscription over the gates of hell, "Abandon hope, all who enter here," might seem appropriate. And yet migrants never lose hope. In fact, it is with and because of hope that they courageously face the difficulties and dangers of migration. One could perhaps even say that courageous hope is the migrant's enduring weapon. They firstly believe in the promise of a better future and continue to do so, despite the odds, against all odds. It is therein how they continue to move across borders despite the difficulties and dangers. It is there in how they put up or fight against isolation and discrimination, in how they refuse to leave and give up, and most of all, in how they continue to weave and nurture dreams for a better life. It is a courageous hope in the sense that it is a hoping against hope, a sense of hope that continues to believe and open itself to possibilities of transformation that can never be fully spoken of. The second characteristic is creative resistance. Migration is fraught with problematic conditions that in many cases amount to oppression. Migrants, however, do not simply submit to or resign themselves to these death-dealing conditions. Under certain circumstances and using strategic means, they actively fight against oppression in their quest for full humanity and liberation. These active attempts to resist oppression and transform their lives are not just on the level of the local, but also that of the global. Communal, not just individual, formal and informal, public and private, and maybe religious, cultural, political, or economic. What is most instructive when it comes to migrant resistance is the way in which some of their strategies are creative and imaginative. These more subtle resistance strategies are a combination of active and passive, yet creative and potentially liberating strategies. They are akin to what Yale professor and anthropologist James Scott calls as hidden transcripts or weapons of the weak, or the unconventional ways such as folk tales, like the legends about Santo Toribio Romo, who is considered as the patron saint of undocumented migrants, particularly among Mexicans and Mexican-Americans. There's a legend about Santo Toribio Romo, whose picture you see there on the screen. But to give you an example, take the case of the use of songs among the migrant Filipino domestic workers in Hong Kong. When much fuss was made by the management of the Dynasty Court, it's an affluent apartment building, about Filipino maids washing their feet after washing their employer's car, the domestic workers did not only call the management notice as an act of upper-class inanity, they also have a song to express their disapproval at the seemingly elitist notice. The notice was as follows: washing oil or dirt off a Mercedes is okay, but not off a maid's feet. So that was the message posted. The song, reflecting the maid's critique of the notice, is sung to the tune of Magtanim Ay Dibiro and has the following lyrics: washing car is little fun, rub and scrub in morning sun. Water flooding down the street, maid wash car but not her feet. I'm not going to sing because it might rain. Yeah? Okay. So the choice of Magtanim Ay Dibiro is significant. It is a song every Filipino knows, or at least most Filipinos know. It extols manual labor, and at the same time, it is some sort of a resistance song against agricultural work, which the American colonizers tried to inscribe among Filipinos by peddling the idea that the Philippines is better off as an agricultural country. Other migrants resort to dropping names that elicit suspicion or discrimination as a kind of a creative resistance, or change into names that will more easily blend with the general population. For example, Chinese immigrant Ti Sheng Cheng became Tommy Cheng to more easily blend in the small town of Rothschild, Wisconsin. Last but not the least, creative resistance is also evidenced in the way migrants reconstitute or transform marginalized public places into spaces which help them in their struggle for greater well-being. Women migrant domestic workers in Singapore who work in the same building and are under strict surveillance by employers, for example, create safe meeting places out of the garbage area and the car park, since these are the places where employers do not tail them. The domestic workers then utilize garbage throwing and car washing time for SOS and socialization. These migrants, like many migrants in various parts of the world, have also transformed basements, car parks, warehouses, small shop lots, and auditoriums into ethnic centers or places of worship. In the following story by noted sociologist Randy David, migrant women entertainers in Japan even try to transform a risky workplace into a safe religious space. David writes, and I quote him here, "I once visited a bar in a suburb of Tokyo where the hostesses were very young Pinays. I was very impressed with the way they dealt with the more aggressive among their Japanese customers. These girls were in total command of themselves and of the situation, even if their Japanese was barely understandable. One of them told me that all five of them prayed together at the beginning and the end of every night, before an image of the Santo Niño, the infant Jesus, which was magnificently enshrined right among the cognac and whiskey bottles." Spirituality involves the totality of life. Thus, it includes the social, political, economic, and cultural dimensions that shape it. For migrants, the challenge lies in integrating these dimensions in view of their quest for authentic human liberation. This brings me to the third characteristic, steadfast faith. When we started the journey, the first thing we did was make the sign of the cross. This statement by a migrant captures in a nutshell the most powerful window into the spirituality of many migrants, that is their steadfast faith. A recent study by the Pew Forum Research Center for Religion and Public Life shows that a whopping 91% of the world's migrants are affiliated with a religion. In fact, almost half, that is 49% of the world's migrants are Christians. Then Daniel even notes in his book, Neighbor Christian Encounters with Illegal Immigration, that migration is a religious phenomenon in the sense that it is a deep physical journey through a spiritual landscape marked with a deep faith and peopled as often as not with angels, demons, or a crowd of folk saints and motivated by a sense of divine purpose. For many migrants, the world is indeed a religious universe. God's grace permeates this earth and meets us constantly in our daily lives, be it in our relationships, in the created world, or in the events of our daily lives. This deep religious faith is like a treasure trove that migrants draw from right from the beginning of their journey. For example, in the book Migration Miracle, Faith, Hope, and Meaning on the Undocumented Journey, Jacqueline Maria Hagen mentions the increasing practice of migration counseling among ministries in the Western Highlands of Guatemala for prospective migrants. Services sought by migrants from their priests as part of the migration counseling range from group prayer by the migrants and their families and sometimes to the congregation, or a mass even, before setting off by foot toward the Mexican border, or asking their pastor or priest to meet with their coyote to determine whether the guide is an honest one or a scoundrel. Prayer, either an individual or communal level, is the most common expression of faith among migrants. Going to mass or participating in church activities ranks next. Even the lack of actual church buildings does not deter them. If there is no church building available for them, they find places and build their own church out of parks, gyms, auditoriums, car parks, warehouses, and abandoned shops. In a sense, the establishment of ethnic churches provides for migrants what could be the single most important source of continuity in the world that has changed in so many ways. And because migrants' religious faith is bound up with their culture or to life's rituals and passages like weddings and funerals and coming-of-age celebrations like quinceañera among Mexican Americans, it plays a prominent role in their lives. Last but not the least, migrants exhibit steadfast faith in the way they keep or hang on to their faith in the midst of hardship. As uprooted people, migrants often rely on or draw from their faith to deal with the ruptures and discontinuities in their lives. The church, for example, is not just the principal site of celebration for ethnic identity and community. It is both a religious and a social center. It is their refuge in times of crisis and their home when they want to shout for joy. Migrants also engage or draw from their faith in their struggle for justice. Wayne Ashley's description on the practice of the Stations of the Cross in a primarily Puerto Rican parish in New York illustrates this. In what is both a public prayer and critique, participants enact each of the Stations of the Cross in strategically chosen problem areas within the parish: a controversial health clinic, a deteriorating public school, a street corner where drugs are sold, a luxury condominium, and a park associated with danger and vice. By traversing through the neighborhood's volatile areas, the participants create two overlapping narratives, one about Christ's suffering and the other about the topography of the East Village and its residents' suffering. What happens is that ongoing social debates and conflicts surrounding housing, welfare, and morality are assimilated into the Christian narrative. The last characteristic, festive community spirit. A festive community spirit also characterizes the migrant way of life. To be sure, there are usually vibrant social circles within migrant communities, which serve as surrogate extended families. Most migrants would belong to one or more of these social circles. These spontaneous extended families or subgroups are strong networks of social interaction as well as mutual support. Among the Finnish-Vietnamese community in Turku, Finland, for example, these strong mutual assistance include various types of practical help, such as interpreting assistance, help with paperwork such as tax declarations, extending financial loans for larger purchases like a car or for larger emergency remittances to relatives in Vietnam, temporary lodgings, all sorts. Such sense of community is also evident in and reinforced by festive, religious, political, and social gatherings. To be sure, migrant community life survives and thrives on injecting a sense of celebration to every imaginable occasion. Moreover, the ways in which food and or the Eucharist play a central role in these festive communal gatherings is noteworthy. In fact, the shared meals that usually follow migrant communities' Eucharistic celebrations and other religious or social gatherings are very instructive. In the first place, the joy of a migrant at not only seeing compatriots, but also at seeing, smelling, and eating home food is priceless. I, for one, remember how delighted and at the same time amazed I was at seeing Filipino delicacies on a table in a house in the Netherlands on my third Sunday in my former country of residence. I have been to a number of similar gatherings in the U.S., Malaysia, Hong Kong, here in Australia, and other parts of the world, and I am very much inclined to say that the shared meal is iconic of the Eucharist. Seeing one is like witnessing the gospel at table. The spirit of joy, the atmosphere of warmth and affection, and the sense of community are such that the experience itself becomes a God experience. It is like seeing the substance of religion and more, the strength that comes from valuing the intangibles, the meanings that are continually created and understood when human beings come together to share their lives and their fears, their meals and their memories. It is the Eucharist in the flesh, rooted in the resiliency, tenacity, the beauty of the human spirit. In many ways, such gatherings fit Eddie Gibbs and Ryan Bolger's description of emerging churches. And I'm quoting both of them here, many emerging churches place a great emphasis on the Eucharist as a central act of worship. The ethos of service is one of hospitality, and all are invited to the table. To be sure, these shared meals and festive communal celebrations are potent reminders that Christian life is not just about individual salvation, but also about collective liberation. They teach us that Christian spirituality must not just be about fasting, but also about celebrating. It must not just be about families, but also about communities. Most of all, they remind us that spirituality must never be confined to prayer or any other religious activity, but to everything that celebrates our humanity. What makes this festive community spirit even more striking is its potentially inclusive character. This character could be glimpsed in how religious activities help facilitate closer relations among migrants within and across ethnic groups, and in some cases, with the wider community. Religious activities organized by the Vietnamese migrant congregations in Turku, Finland, for example, are generally inclusive and open to non-members. The devotion to Our Lady of Guadalupe and the annual celebration of the Virgin's Feast in Miami also illustrates this inclusive character. The Marian devotion involves not only every national Hispanic community, but also the whole Anglo community in all its ethnic diversity, as well as the Haitian community in Miami. There is even an annual pilgrimage to the Virgin of Guadalupe involving all the parishes of the Archdiocese. Indeed, migrant spirituality is first and foremost about nurturing relationships, particularly through festive community gatherings and events. Migrant spirituality and mission today. So how could migrant spirituality help us understand, envision, and practice mission today? I will attempt to answer this question by offering reflections on three possible facets of mission today based on the above-mentioned characteristics of migrant spirituality. The first one is mission among the crucified people. The reality of suffering that pervades the lives of migrants is a reminder that mission today entails mission among the crucified people, not just among migrants, but among the millions who suffer from poverty, violence, and all forms of injustice. Coined by Jesuit theologian Ignacio de la Corriere, crucified people refers to that, and I'm quoting him here, that collective body, which as the majority of humanity owes its situation of crucifixion to the way society is organized and maintained by a minority that exercises its dominion through a series of factors which, taken together and given their concrete impact within history, must be regarded as sin. End of quote. The crucified people, in other words, are the actual presence of the crucified Christ in history. In this crucified people, Christ acquires a body in history, and we are challenged, in the words of John Sobrino, to take the crucified people down from the cross. Note that I said mission among the crucified people and not simply mission to the crucified people. It is a reminder that mission is not the privilege of a few, but a call and a task for all. Just as mission in the context of migration is not just mission to migrants, but also mission of migrants, the crucified people, because and despite of their struggles for justice, also participate in the mission of liberation. Their struggles embody a luminescent faith, hope, and communal solidarity that have helped desperate communities to survive in the face of overwhelming odds. The second dimension, mission as pilgrimage in the wilderness. Mission, like migrant spirituality, could also be understood as a pilgrimage in the wilderness. As a people who travel with courageous hope and steadfast faith across deserts and seas in search of greener pastures and of their own promised land, migrants' journeys are like a pilgrimage. Insofar as their journeys force them to struggle to survive and to a certain extent thrive, in strange and oftentimes hostile places, theirs is an experience of pilgrimage in the wilderness. Let's consider the first part of the phrase, mission as pilgrimage. As a pilgrimage, mission connotes a movement that is both physical and spiritual. On the one hand, it could be about rediscovering the God of Revelation in the context of leaving, of going out to other places as Abraham, Paul, and countless Christian missionaries over the ages did. On the other hand, such movement may not necessarily be about going out to other places or going overseas, but simply a movement out of our comfort zone. Like Peter, James, and John at the transfiguration of Jesus, sometimes the temptation is to stay or keep doing the things we have been doing because we are happy or things are going well. Mission as pilgrimage means having the courage to discern and accept when it's time to move on for various reasons. Like the multiple, multidirectional, and difficult but transforming journeys that migrants undertake, mission is about a constant coming and going, continuous departure and arrival, and like Christian life, a process of continuous transformation. Mission as pilgrimage consequently points to the provisional character of missionary work. That which is provisional is temporary, and most certainly comes with great vulnerability. But as Brazilian nun and theologian Yvonne Guevara contends, spirituality in that which is provisional, that which is fleeting, is an expression of faith and life. The challenge is to embrace being a pilgrim, or in the words of Lumen Gentium, being a pilgrim church. Pilgrim people or pilgrim communities have a profound experience of God. As they move from one reality to another, so does their God, who is not established in a solid temple, but shares in their provisional life. God walks alongside them and becomes a pilgrim on the roads of this uneven world, nurturing and blessing them by the power of renewed relationships and community within the household of life. Let's now consider the second part of the phrase, in the wilderness. Wilderness as a concept has a negative, as a wild land or a place that is beyond the control of humans, and a positive meaning, as a place that nurtures the human spirit. Based on the experience of the Israelites, in the wilderness, nations are recreated, people are renamed, sacrifices are made, callings are discerned, spiritual acumen is honed, God's grace is revealed, and God's people are renewed. To enter into the wilderness is to plumb the depths of the human experience, to find clues for articulating how human beings forge and renew their relationship with the sacred. Accordingly, mission as pilgrimage in the wilderness highlights the need to embrace risk. Some years ago, I was invited to speak on women's risky initiatives in the name of the gospel at a seminar in Lyon, France, of the directors of the Pontifical Mission Societies. One valuable insight from that session came back to me at an international conference on Vatican II in India earlier this year, where I was invited to speak about social justice. And that insight is that we need more missionaries in more risky ministries. In a session I attended in the latter conference, the priest presenter lamented what he perceives as a trend of increasing concentration of missionary work in charitable work. There are so many Mother Teresas, he said. Do not get me wrong. Charitable work certainly comes with risk, and it needs as much people as it could get. For example, many years ago, I volunteered as a tutor for street children after work. The residential school for street children was built and run by a religious congregation. One night, a terrified stay-in volunteer told me and my fellow volunteer tutors that there won't be tutorial sessions that night because the place is on lockdown because of a security incident. The fear in the stay-in volunteer's eyes testifies to the potential risk in what is relatively a safe type of volunteer work. There is, however, in my opinion, a great need for missionary work in areas that might involve more risks. We need as much Domhelder cameras just as we need Mother Teresa's. Given the more serious difficulties and greater dangers, work in risky ministries is understandably discouraging. For example, the late Archbishop Camara, who is known for his advocacy and work for the poor, and you can see his picture there, was subjected to numerous interrogations and threats. At one point, there's a story that says that he was offered private bodyguards by friends, which he turned down by saying, and he says this is very interesting, "I already have 3 security guards, Father, Son, and Spirit." As could be seen in the late Archbishop's words, as well as the prophet Elijah's experience of God in what is probably the darkest moment of the prophet's life, God never abandons us in the wilderness. God may not be in the wind, in the earthquake, or in the fire, but in the still, small voice, as Elijah experienced, or in the silence of our hearts, in our moments of prayer, in the face of the other. What is important is to overcome the fear, the temptation to give up, and not to succumb to defeat when the wilderness seems overpowering. But instead, be courageous in our hope, steadfast in our faith, as well as creative in our coping or resistance strategies like the migrants. We could also draw some wisdom from the last line from Robert Frost's poem, "Stopping by the Woods on a Snowy Evening." And the last few lines says, "The woods are lovely, dark, and deep, but I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep." Mission as embracing an ethic of risk is also helpful in dealing with burnout and the so-called compassion fatigue in missionary work. Mission, especially in the context of the struggle for justice, should begin with the recognition that we cannot guarantee decisive changes and the achievement of desired ends in the near future or even in our lifetime. We can only possibly create a matrix of conditions in which further actions are possible or the possibility for desired changes are possible. An ethic of risk as responsible action means that those who work among crucified peoples need to name, find, and create other resources that evoke persistent defiance in the face of repeated defeats. This sheer holy boldness is about deciding to care and act, although there are no guarantees of success. It is not easy, Sharon Welch says, as such action requires immense, deep daring. At the same time, however, it also enables deep joy. As Welch contends, and I'm quoting her here, "An ethic of risk may appear modest, yet it offers the potential of sustained resistance against overwhelming odds. The aim is simple. Given that we cannot guarantee an end to racism nor the prevention of all war, we can prevent our own capitulation to structural evil. We can participate in a long heritage of resistance, standing with those who have worked for change in the past. We can also take risks trying to create the conditions that will evoke and sustain further resistance. We can help create the conditions necessary for justice and peace, realizing that the choices of others can only be influenced and responded to, never controlled. We cannot make their choices. We can only provide a heritage of resistance, imagination, and solidarity. End of quote. Thus, mission as pilgrimage in the wilderness discourages messianic complex. It is a reminder that we are not saviors and we cannot save the world. We can only do so much toward making the world a better place. This is oftentimes the character of incarnational engagement. Ultimately, the task of social transformation is an ongoing challenge and process. This drives home the eschatological truth that redemption's already aspect is as real as redemption's not yet. What is helpful in this regard is embracing the truth that mission is Missio Dei, as Steve has spoken to us about. The last one is mission as a consistent ethic of hope and life. Last but not the least, there is a consistent ethic of hope and life that runs through migrant spirituality, which could be helpful in envisioning and doing mission today, as could be seen in their courageous hope, creative resistance, and festive community spirit. Migrants' lives are not just about suffering and death. It is also about joys and successes. Migrants are not just victims. They are also subjects and agents of their own destiny. While often pushed to live on the borders of society, migrants refuse to do so completely and persistently struggle to create spaces for themselves to survive. At the heart of this dogged determination to struggle is the unwavering and defiant hope for a better life. In the words of the late Cuban-American theologian Ada Maria Isace Diaz, la vida es la lucha. To struggle is to live. So what does consistent ethic of hope and life mean in the context of mission? Hope, as it is understood and used in this presentation, differs from emotion or mere optimism. Rather, it is employed here in an eschatological sense, particularly as both an ethical activity and theological virtue. Anthony Kelly's writings on the links between hope and life are instructive in this regard. Kelly contends that as an ethical activity, hope looks beyond self regarding satisfactions to the transcendent values that alone can nourish life and give it direction. Thus, hope refuses to see the ultimate meaning of life as simply more of the same. It is patiently open to what is and what must be otherwise. It cannot rest except in the truly meaningful and the genuinely good, thereby increasing the scope and energies of the human spirit in the quest for the fullness of life. Hope then breeds the conviction that what is deepest in our aspirations is not ultimately worthless or self-defeating. Kelly notes further that hope is not mere wishing for something more. It is a conduct of life, a mode of living and acting which inspires action. It engenders a deep moral sense and points in the direction of a more passionate self-involvement in the making of the world and risking even life itself for the greater good of oneself or others. As a theological virtue, hope is not only about giving thanks for what is already given, but also being open to what is beyond all imagination and control. Hope for oneself then expands to hope for others, interceding for all who are our companions in the light and shadow of the history we share. As is the case among many migrants, this hope-filled vision and way of life could be nourished in missionary work by faith that is rooted in prayer, a sense of community, and a joyful spirit. Let us first consider prayer. Because it taps into some of the deepest places of loneliness and longings lodged in the human heart, prayer allows us to develop that intimate conversation with Christ that enables us to abide with Him and know each other as intimate friends. As the doorway to spiritual depth, human meaning, and genuine intimacy, prayer allows us to perceive more clearly the truths of life. Exercised in private and in community, prayer builds and nourishes our relationships. This is because prayer is not just a psychological tool for self-actualization, but also a spiritual grace that facilitates human transformation. This makes prayer especially important for those involved in the work of justice. In missionary work, action and contemplation must go together, for they complement one another. Prayer and justice are two sides of the same spiritual coin. Justice without prayer quickly degenerates into frenetic social activism, but prayer without justice could also be hollow and empty. Second, a sense of community or doing collaborative missionary work is also key to nurturing a hope-filled life in the context of mission. Missionary work can be lonely and exhausting, so companionship and relationality is critical. Jesus illustrates the importance and power of relationships in Mark chapter 6, verse 7, in missionary endeavors when he sent the disciples not on their own but by twos, okay, by pair. Relationship is constitutive of who we are and what we can become. Relationality is decisive for our humanity. The most fruitful and meaningful missionary works are not really done in isolation, but in communion. Last but not the least, a joyful spirit is also important in nurturing a hope-filled life in mission. As Harvey Cox says, Christians who laugh are insisting that the stories of the world's sufferings do not have the last word. To be sure, the enormity and gravity of missionary work can be exhausting and overwhelming. Thus, finding ways to celebrate in the midst of the stress and challenges is helpful. The Eucharist not only serves as a source, but also provides a basis for this. As Lawrence Cunningham and Keith Egan contend, but to celebrate the Eucharist well, we must learn first of all how to celebrate, to make festival, to make Sabbath. What does not happen outside of Eucharist will not happen at the Eucharist. We cannot become instant celebrators, festive people merely by walking through a church door. We cannot celebrate the Eucharist well if we do not celebrate elsewhere. End of quote. These celebratory moments do not have to be big or grand, but as simple as our everyday experiences of transfiguration or moments of light. Moments of transfiguration are lanterns to hold and carry us through. Even when these moments pass, even when the darkness comes, God remains. These moments of light help us get through the hard times. In conclusion, migrants are without doubt people in search of a better life for themselves and their families. This quest for life or greater well-being is the enduring theme of wave after wave, generation after generation of migrants worldwide. What is clear for migrants is that well-being is not achieved in a static state, but in dynamic, purposeful, life-changing movements. Migrants move in order to live. In the process, they encounter death, but like Jesus, dying is not the last word, but resurrection, and consequently, new life or hope. Thus, migrant life is rich with situations where death meets life and hope overcomes fear and despair. It is a reminder that in God's great economy of salvation, hope, not death, is the last word. That's why we're Easter people. This, I reckon, is the heart of Christian mission. It is about persistently believing and witnessing to the reality that in the midst of pain and sin, it is possible to discover God's abundant grace in unexpected and amazing ways. The great Christian proclamation of salvation recognizes the depth and reality of evil, and then in embracing it, overcomes it. As part of the Christian proclamation of salvation, mission insists that life is bigger than death, that love is greater than hatred, that goodness is far deeper than evil. Thus, like the migrant way of life, mission is about being pilgrims of hope. It is about moving and moving on, about never giving up on the vision for a better life and never giving up on oneself, in others, in the world, and in one's faith, even in the midst of hardship. It is about faithfully and persistently building and nurturing hope par excellence. Habakkuk chapter 2, verses 2 to 3 drives home this point. And I'm quoting from the text here. Write down the vision clearly upon the tablets so that one can read it readily. For the vision still has its time, presses on to fulfillment, and will not disappoint. If it delays, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not be late. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Gemma, for a very solid input. There were so many ideas and images in your paper that will really repay further reflection and unpacking. What really do these things mean for each of us in how we go about our own mission activity? We'll have a little help in a moment from Dr. John Falzon in this task of beginning to unpack the meaning of Gemma's paper. John is the Chief Executive Officer of the St Vincent de Paul Society, National Council of Australia. He's worked in academia, in research, in advocacy, in community building, and he's also a published poet, which might help us with so many of the rich images that were in Gemma's talk. John, can I invite you now to come and give your response to Gemma's paper?
Thank you very much for that introduction, Sandy. And I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners and custodians of the land on which we're meeting, particularly in the light of Gemma's beautiful presentation. I would like to pay tribute to their spirit of collective resistance, collective dreaming, and collective hope. I'm going to start with a little story because I always find it a great challenge to be the respondent when everything that needed to be said has been said, particularly so eloquently as it was by Gemma this morning. So here's the story. Take it as you will. It could also be used as a summary of perhaps Gemma's beautiful motif of joy. In my family, my wife and I, we are very strict religious devotees of the teachings of Mark Latham. We always read to our children at night. One particular night, my son, who was then probably about eight, didn't want to read to me, and he didn't want me to read to him. He just wanted us to lie side by side on his bed and read our respective books, which we did, and it was a pure joy. After a little while, my son Gian turns to me and says, "You know, Papa, I can't get to sleep at night unless I read first." I said, "Me too, son." Then he said, "That's because when I become an adult, I want to be like you." And a little pause, and then, well, not bald. Another tiny pause, or fat. My son is king of the one-liners, He runs rings around all of us, but on this occasion he wasn't trying to be a smart aleck. He was just stating the obvious, just in case I didn't get it. And the obvious was that the limits of his desire for emulation were the desire to read, and that was it. He was well aware of my intellectual limitations, and that's why he believed he needed to state the obvious. God love him. In many ways, I apologise beforehand because I'm going to be stating the obvious here to you because you've heard it so beautifully presented in Gemma's very considered reflection on the meaning of what it is to really be alive. If I could generalise it that far out. I really believe that's what she has presented us with as a modest contribution to that vision of what it is to be fully human, fully alive. I particularly have to say that the image of a crucified people that Gemma has used, courtesy of Father Elacuria, is just magnificent and something that we all need to be reminded of. Again, it is the obvious that needs to be restated. And of course, that definition is just dripping with truth. And yet it is such a radical vision to define the crucified people as people who have been crucified, not because it's some obscure will of God, not because it is fate, not because it is bad choices, which I have to tell you is still the dominant discourse today, that people suffer because they make bad choices. Even Mark Latham, who I joked about earlier, he's recently written the quarterly essay, and again he restated, and this is someone who should know better, dare I say, he restated this horrible thesis. He said, the problem with the underclass, these are the words he used, is their inability to make good choices. So this is the dominant view in the world today, in the prosperous world, of why there is such a thing as this this phenomenon of collective crucifixion. But this prophetic counter message is that no, this is not bad choices. It's not luck. It's not fate. It is due to the way society and the economy is organised. It is something done to. It is something that is systematically, structurally, historically imposed, and we can't get away from it no matter how much we wish to domesticate that wild tiger, which is the gospel, into a very tame pussycat. We can't get away from that ultimate reality that this crucified people in our midst are a prophetic call to us to blast nails from the cross, in the words of the Peruvian poet Cesar Vallejo. I'm reminded on that score of something that happened to me some years ago when I was working in community development. I had the privilege of, I didn't run this, I just was invited to sit in on a group of parents who were drug addicts or recovering drug addicts, and they'd formed a group sharing and writing their stories. That was the community arts project, to produce a book of stories from their lives. And it was very moving, and I'm a strong believer in the healing, salvific power of story, the liberating power of story. And I remember very clearly one young Aboriginal woman telling me what life was like in very simple words, without any embellishment, any desire for pity, just telling me the truth of her crucifixion, in a sense. And she described what it was like to be a sex worker in order to be able to support her heroin habit as well as to feed her children. She described what it was like to walk down the street and be simply walking down the street to the shop and to be hassled by the police because she was black. She described all of these things, and she described what it was like to regularly end up in the police cells. And I naively was grasping for things to say, to respond to, just as I am this morning, and said to her, you know, so when you're in the cells, like, what do? Do you just try and sleep off the time so it goes faster? And she turned to me with these piercing eyes and she said, oh no, she said, the cells are a sad place. The cells are a sad place, brother. You don't get to sleep in the cells. And it turned my world upside down for many reasons, but after I reflected on it, the thing that struck me most was that one word nestled in amongst the others that she spoke to me, the word brother. She bestowed on me the greatest gift imaginable, and in doing so, she took me with her into the world of the prison cell, into the world of crucifixion on the basis of being a member of a colonised people. She called me brother, not because I did anything to deserve it. It was pure gift, pure grace that she gave to me. And it was liberating as well as hortatory, you know, in the sense that she was calling me in a prophetic way to take part in that magnificent, the most human, the most sacred project of all, and that is the project of liberation. In many ways, that project of liberation, that revolution, because as Oscar Romero pointed out, you know, he said, the Beatitudes turn everything upside down. Well, if that isn't the definition of a revolution, I don't know what is. So that call to revolutionary turning upside down the values of the world, the values of a world that dares to crucify people systematically, that has to come from below. It can never be imposed from above. That's the collective movement for social change. And Gemma put it very beautifully when she said that the Christian life is not just about individual salvation, but also about collective liberation. Now, I would put it to you that if we consider the etymology of salvation, of that concept of health, wholeness, fullness, then we can take Gemma's thesis to the absolute limit, because it is so true. And we can say that not only is Christian life not just about individual salvation, but we can say that life is not just about individual salvation, individual fulfilment, individual health, but is about that collective liberation, that project of collective liberation. Lilla Watson, an Aboriginal activist, and a group of fellow Aboriginal activists in Queensland in the 70s coined that absolutely poignant couple of words that to me in many ways sum up what I feel that we are all called to. She and her comrades said, "If you have come to help me, you are wasting your time. But if you have come because your liberation is bound up with mine, then let us work together." How beautiful a way of communicating the very things that Gemma was reflecting on with us this morning. I love the way she spoke about that hope against hope, the hope that Paul spoke of in reference to Abraham, of course. I like to think of that hope against hope as an almost hopeless hope. I think of the people who, the asylum seekers, who come here on a leaky boat with nothing but that tiny nugget of hope in their pockets. That's all they have, literally, that hopeless hope, that hope that's so close to despair that you could almost mistake it for despair. But there's one crucial difference between that hopeless hope and despair, and that is despair is a situation and it's part of that process of systemic oppression. Despair is when you are convinced that there is no alternative, that this is how things are meant to be. So whether it's the asylum seeker or whether it's the woman who is experiencing violence in the family context, if she thinks, if she is convinced and all the forces around her, in the immediate vicinity at least, are working at that very personal and political, to use the the wonderful coinage of the women's liberation movement, working to convince her that this is what it's meant to be. This is what she deserves. She doesn't deserve anything but this, and there can be no alternative. In the words of the late Margaret Thatcher, you know, there is no alternative, when she was referring to the terrible, in fact, effects of globalised capitalism. That's despair. It's not irrevocable, but hope is when she gets up in the morning and says, damn it, I don't know what's out there. I don't know whether I'm going to be sleeping in my car, which is probably what is going to happen, but I'm going to leave. That's the hopeless hope. Now, I've just been given a note to say that, John, you're hopeless, and you've only got 1 minute left. So how will I use that 1 minute? Well, I will use it by saying this. First of all, I can't leave you without sharing those beautiful words of St. Augustine on hope, that hope has two beautiful daughters. Their names are anger and courage. Anger at the way things are and courage to make sure that they do not stay the way they are. That, to me, has always been a very helpful formulation. But I will leave you with this thought, that in effect, sometimes we can be very much daunted by this, the enormity of this project, the enormity of this prophetic call to engage in liberation, in solidarity with our sisters and brothers who are well and truly the crucified people in history. But I would simply share with you, you know, that beautiful insight by Paulo Freire when he said, only the power that springs from the weakness of the oppressed is sufficiently strong to free both the oppressor and the oppressed. And in a sense, if I could take that a step further and say, it falls to us, especially to us who are weak, to make life beautiful. It falls especially to us, even when we are filled with fear, even when we are filled with a sense of uncertainty and ignorance, it falls to us out of our own weakness, out of our beautiful humanity, to make life beautiful. And our lives will have been something very beautiful if, at the end of it all, if we can say that we carried even one single grain of sand to the building site of a new society. Thank you very much.